Irina, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for talking to me.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Awesome. So I understand you have to be a bit cryptic, but I hear you just come back from a bit of a hunt.
Just had a huge hunting adventure down in the South Island. It was very exciting. Yes.
Okay. Well, good to know it's in the South Island. This is the place to be, of course. you might have been on horseback.
We may or may not have been on horses.
Okay,
yes.
Good stuff. Have you done a lot of horseback hunting in the past, or is that something you do? Because you do have horses on your farm, right?
Yes, that's right. So I've been riding since I was around, well, just a little girl, really, since I had my first horse when I was 9. So I think I'm pretty much better on a horse than I am on my own 2 feet. I've never hunted off horseback before, so that is a very new experience, and I would really like to get into that now. So currently, you know, the horses I've had before have been sport horses, thoroughbreds mostly, jumping, dressage, eventing, that sort of thing. And now I'm thinking more about getting a horse that I can take out hunting and have hunting adventures with.
So how's that horse different? Just more sure on its feet and kind of maybe a bit stockier or something? Like, how do you think that horse is different from a jumping horse?
It's how you train them mostly, I think, but it's also personality. So you're looking for a horse that's just a little bit calmer, that is a little bit better under pressure. And what I mean by that, just takes a little bit of a moment to think about life before reacting, and is sort of, you know, gun trained and trained to sort of stand quite quietly and things like that. So you're looking for a horse that's physically strong, can weather different weather events, is sure-footed, has really good feet, and is less reactive, so less likely to pick up and run. You know, we know that horses are prey animals, right? So their response when challenged is to leave the situation. So you just wanted them to think about that before they leave.
Yeah, for sure. We did a lot of outrides. My dad did endurance riding when we were kids. And I remember the calmest horses ever were the police horses. So my father was in the army, and then you always admire these police horses that were never reactive to anything. They just kind of stood there. So I guess that's kind of the similar thing you want in a kind of a trekking, hunting horse, perhaps.
100%. So it's a combination of breed and train.
Yeah, for sure. Just on that, are you still doing any events, or are you just riding for kind of just your own pleasure at the moment?
Just riding for pleasure at the moment. I had both my hips replaced last year, actually. So I'm just building up strength and flexibility at the moment. So I'm back on the horse, but just, you know, doing farm rides and hacking out and obviously, you know, a bit of a hunting adventures every now and again.
I'm making a massive assumption here, because you just talked about your hips. Is that because of you had a bit of a dancing career that there's been, is that a dancing career injury?
Horse riding accidents, actually.
Oh, okay.
About 15 years ago or so, or maybe a decade, time blurs a little bit. I had quite a nasty horse riding accident, and I broke my hips and my back.
Oh, wow.
I recovered from that, but the hip replacement was as a result of that. So I'm a firm believer of take opportunities and get stuck into life and don't hop back. And so that's what we've done. But obviously it comes with a few tears and trips. Yep. And a few broken bones over time.
Yeah. Well, that's great. You know, I used to do a lot of rock climbing, and I've had a couple of shoulder operations, or I had a shoulder operation. And then I think, you know, what do you want in the end? Do you want to die in perfect nick or do you want to say, well, you know, I did a lot of rock climbing and the shoulder isn't working anymore. You know, it's kind of this, the glory and the scars mean you've done a couple of things.
Definitely. Yeah. I'm on that train. I'd rather wear out.
For sure. I just want to, like, where are you based?
I live in the Manawatu. My home is in this beautiful little part of the world called Waitona West. It's rolling sheep and beef country, and the Rangitiki River's on my back door. So I'm very lucky.
And, do you, as a CEO of Fish and Game, actually get out to hunt and fish a lot, or are you just stuck in work most of the time?
I try and make the opportunity to get out, horse ride and hunt and fish. It's really important for mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
It's good for my physical health as well. It enables me to just get away from the computers and the conversations and the texts, and actually just think about, as an organization, what we're doing and where we're going. It enables me to retain my perspective so that I can be calm when under pressure, and that's what you really need to be so you can lead an organization. So I try and get out as much as possible. I try and do something every weekend,
yeah,
irrespective of what it is. It might just be going for a walk down a river to scare trout, if we're being honest. It could be some armed hiking, or it might even be taking the horses for a bit of a stroll, but I try and do something every weekend. Yeah. But the work is quite intense. It's not, you know, it's not a 40 hour a week job. It's 24/7 sort of thing. And I just create some boundaries and make some time for myself as part of that.
What's the easiest for you to do if you're going as hunting, fishing? Is the fishing kind of on the doorstep type of thing, or what do you, if you've got half a day, what do you do?
I probably do a little bit of both. My ideal, actually, we've got some beautiful rivers through the Manawatu. I can't talk about where they are. People that live here will know them though. Yeah. So there's an opportunity to actually go for a stroll up the river with a fishing rod, with your dog, and with a rifle. Yeah. And you've got the opportunity to train your dog. So it's great. I've got a German Shorthaired Pointer. He's amazing, and he's just been trained at the moment. He's doing really well. So I get him out. I can catch a fish, and there might be the likelihood of spotting a deer early morning or in the evening. So, you know, we've just got a beautiful environment here that really provides all of those opportunities.
I assume you grew up doing this, or did you fall into it like later in life? Were you raised to hunt and fish?
My dad, my family is a keen outdoors family, but mostly, you know, I was born up in Northland, and half my family's up in Northland and half my family's in New Plymouth. And I moved to New Plymouth when I was quite young, probably about 4 or 5 years of age. My family's really outdoorsy, so they love the environment and they're constantly sort of out. And mostly they were sea fishing, so a lot out in boats and things like that. And I grew up swimming in the ocean and floundering in the estuaries and that sort of thing, you know, quite wild children with my cousins. Getting into the hunting and trout fishing, that's been something that I've done a little bit later in life, and I've really got a passion for it. So we did a bit of trout, you know, freshwater fishing, trout fishing earlier on, and a little bit of a duck hunting and sort of learning a bit of safety around rifles and use of rifles. But it's really sort of been quite recently that I've fully embraced it and focusing on taking time to actually go out and enjoy it and gain more skills.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I'm jumping around a bit, but your German Shorthaired Pointer, how old is he?
He's probably a year and a half now. Yep, I got him. I got him about 8 months or so ago. So, you know, he was an older dog. I didn't get him as a puppy, but he's beautiful. He's very, very natural and he's very calm. If anyone knows German Shorthaired Pointers, they can be very, very high energy. Yeah. They're really engaging, but it takes you've got to have a certain personality, I think, to work with them or enjoy them. And he's lovely. He's very, very natural. So we're just building his confidence. I shot my first deer over him a couple of weekends ago, and he was really stable, just lay beside me. It took me into the deer, then lay beside me while we were shooting, and didn't flinch at all. So I was really impressed with him, and then helped me recover the deer. So that was quite good. It was quite a bit of a bush bash. So it took a couple of hours to find him.
Is that your main goal with him, deer, or are you will you put some bird time in him also?
So GSBs are naturally upland game dogs, so quite fast. Yeah, I'm not quite fast enough to keep up with him at the moment, so I'm trying to teach him to be close. Yes, but my ideal is I want to do a lot of pheasants over him. So I love pheasant hunting, so I'm really looking forward to the opening of the game season coming up, you know, first weekend of May.
Yeah, I've said it on other podcasts, but I just got into pheasant shooting when we were staying in Auckland and then moving down to Invercargill. I did not realize there's no pheasants or quail here. So I'll do a bit of jump shooting for duck when the season opens, because I think that's the closest you get to that kind of vibe. Would in your role in fishing game, would you say your passion lies more with the hunting or fishing, or with the natural resource itself, with kind of protecting that habitat?
I think originally when I started working for Fish and Game, my passion really was in environmental protection and species monitoring and management.
Yeah.
And as you know, as I've developed as a person and as I've spent more time out hunting and fishing, then very much hunting and fishing is core of that. But I don't think you can separate those two because you can't you won't have these opportunities to get out and harvest wild kai if you don't have a healthy environment and then access to that healthy environment. So I don't separate them. For me, they go hand in glove.
Yep.
And you have to do the environmental advocacy and environmental protection work in order to be able to have these opportunities to harvest wild food from the environment.
From what I've heard speaking to other people, you know, you do a lot. Tell me a bit about your dancing career and if was there any ever any chance that that was going to be your full-time career?
No, I don't think so. And because I was competitive, so I danced right through till sort of early 20s, I suppose, when I started traveling a little bit more for work. And I did ballet and jazz and danced competitively. And I really enjoyed it, but I didn't have that burning passion to turn it into my livelihood.
Yeah.
I was actually getting around the horses. So I played around with the idea of just training horses professionally for my career, for my life. And I did that a little bit early on and then stopped it. So more I was loved dancing. It was really good for my mental development, I think. It teaches you discipline,
yeah.
Teaches you about where your limits are and how to push through those limits.
Yeah.
Great for learning how to deal with pain, I think.
Yeah,
the things that dancers don't talk about. And it builds strength, obviously. So I'm really happy that I did it. And I dance a lot now just for my own enjoyment. It's just a way of expressing myself. But no, I didn't want to have a career in it. I was more interested sort of in the horses and in the outdoors in relation to career opportunities.
And that hardcore physical exercise, I think, has definite benefits in terms of like a career. Like teaching you to like be resilient. There's definite links between, you know, physical exercise and biting the bullet and kind of biting the bullet when things get tough in work, I assume.
That's right. Yeah. It teaches you to push through your boundaries. So I've just become aware of where my boundaries might be, but you know, developed a really strong nature and can push through those, you know, to points until you break, obviously. Yes. And I think it's been really good for that. It teaches you to be tough.
Yeah. There's a lot of international listeners for the podcast. Just remind me again, and then maybe just so they know, like, what Fish and Game does. Because when I started hunting and fishing here, I didn't really know. There were signboards up. That was my access, and you bought a license. But doing a bit of work with Fish and Game, I really realized the insane amount of work that you and everyone at Fish and Game does. Like, just what's your mandate, and then just kind of in general, what does it cover?
That's right. So a lot of people think that all Fish and Game does is set, you know, regulations and then do compliance around those regulations. And while we do that, and that's a core part of what the organization was set up to accomplish, the organization does far more than that. So it's an organization that's a statutory organization. It's under the Conservation Act, and it has the mandate to manage and enhance sports fish and game bird resources for recreational hunters and anglers. And so what that means is it monitors populations. It monitors the health of the environment that those populations rely on. It ensures that we set sustainable harvest limits for those populations and we monitor compliance against those. The organisation also does a huge amount in the environment protections type of space. So we do a lot with wetlands. So we do wetland restoration, rehabilitation and enhancement. I think $22 million has been spent on our wetland work and since we started. We also do a huge amount to protect freshwater, and so that's raising issues around freshwater management and health, and a lot of work with communities so that they're putting their money in the best place for rehabilitating these habitats if they need to be rehabilitated, obviously, or managing them where they're already good. We do a lot of work with regional councils and, you know, sort of regional based government and then a lot of work with the government as well to look at what sustainable policies might look like. So we work with them to make sure that they are fit for purpose, and we're doing a real focus on helping reduce bureaucracy so that, you know, what the systems we've got in place do the job without unduly restricting people or impacting on people that shouldn't be impacted on.
I think Fish and Game is a bit in the public eye, like a bit of an iceberg. We just see the tip, and then there's so much happening underneath that no one's aware. Do you think the general hunter out there or fisherman knows what you're doing?
I think it's probably an issue in relation to Fish and Game social license that there's a lot the organisation does that doesn't have a really high profile or people don't understand. So that's one of the focuses that I've got and we've got as an organisation is to try and allow people to see below the hood, I suppose, or, you know, to see the iceberg that's sitting below the water in relation to what the organisation actually achieves. It's a tiny organisation. It's only got about 77 staff and it really it achieves amazing outcomes with small resources and small inputs. It's very effects-based focus. So not much bureaucracy, a streamlined ship that just really gets stuff done.
From the work I've done with some of the staff, everyone under you are really grinding away. You know, when you try and reach someone, they're out in the field, they're busy working, on papers. I don't see anyone sitting around doing nothing from the people I've worked with. And I think the habitat is really going to benefit from that in the long run. And I've become a massive fan of Fish and Game because just seeing what's, you know, the bottom part of that iceberg. How do you like see the general person working for Fish and Game? Because it's like a weird mix for me. It's everyone's a bit of a greenie because they really want the habitat to thrive, but they're all both most of them are, you know, hand fish. So you've got like politically you would associate these people with two poles, but they're not that. Like how do you see that general person? Like what's their passion and like what gets them out there?
Our teams are amazing. I mean, that's what brought me back to the organization. It was sort of what the organization stood for. And I already knew from working for Fish and Game previously what the organization could achieve. But the real drawback to the organization was the people that work for Fish and Game. Yeah. You can't pigeonhole them. They are passionate conservationists, but hugely practical with that. They are driven by an enjoyment of getting out into an environment. They want to see a healthy environment. They want everyone to be able to access that environment. And most of them, if not all of them, will hunt or fish or go out and recreate in the environment as part of their values, as part of what they do as a person for their well-being. Most of them, a lot of them hunt and fish, so they'll be out in the weekends doing hunting and fishing, and during the week they'll be protecting the environment and monitoring the population. So they probably what I'd say is all of them across the organisation, they're passion-driven. So they are self-motivated and they get the job done and they work amazingly well as a team. So I couldn't speak highly enough of the people within this organization. And they're incredibly fun people too.
Yeah, and it's a diverse bunch. But I've been in the Southland office a couple of times and everyone's a bit different with a different passion, which is pretty cool. And I think for someone, like I've really been into the fly fishing thing for 5 years now and kind of just the Kiwi way of hunting for 4 years, and you know, people keep their cards close at heart. You know, where do you hunt, and they kind of don't want to tell you where. But for someone starting out, if you go into an office like that or pick up the phone and ask them for advice, they're like super keen to help new people out. That's really benefited me. Like they'll be like, "Yeah, try that river, try that spot. This is how you jump shoot." So I mean, that's maybe just like a tiny part of what that team's supposed to do, but for me that's really been good, like feeling I can pick up the phone and ask someone for advice, and they're always keen. I've been hearing a lot about restructuring Fish and Game, and I think you've spoken about this on a bunch of other platforms. Maybe just talk to me a bit about that, like where was it or where do you want it to go in maybe in the next 10 years?
I wasn't brought on to restructure the organization at all. My main focus for Fish and Game is to stabilize it, so to build high performing or support the teams to be high performing across the organization. So to create a bit more connection and cohesion across the entire Fish and Game organization, because as you'd be aware, the way the organization is set up at the moment is I work for the New Zealand Council. It's sort of the 13th council, I suppose.
Yep.
The organization's got 12 autonomous regional councils and they all employ their own teams. They all work really well together, but I've just been focusing on building that sort of one team mentality and getting them to work across regions and a bit more consistency in the policies that we have, for example. Yeah, so that's really been my focus. It's really on culture and governance and connection. So they can just carry on doing the great work that they're doing. there was a ministerial review around about 5 years ago, and that's where all the tension sort of started, and it highlighted that the organisation had some challenges and needed to take some steps to modernise. So we've been working through and implementing those non-legislative requirements of the ministerial review, and that's going really well. The legislative stuff that the review talked about was regional amalgamations, essentially reducing the number of regions. That's outside of my bandwidth.
Yeah.
What happens in relation to structural change, that depends on the governors across the organisation and also obviously the Minister of Hunting and Fishing, because some of these changes or a lot of these changes, legislative changes, will require legislative change, and the only you know, people that really have influence over that, you know, is central government. So it will be their call at the end of the day. And my role is to implement our statutory functions, keep everyone together, support all our teams, make sure it's a safe, healthy working environment, and support delivery to license holders. We've got some big challenges that are outside of the things we've been talking about, like social license.
Yeah.
So yeah, the focus for me is to make sure the organisation is match fit in relation to what those challenges are that it's facing at the moment and into the future.
Yeah, I want to touch on the Minister of Hunting and social license a bit later, because I just, there's things I wonder about. But what's the biggest challenge Fish and Game itself as an organisation faces now? Is it this that you've been talking about, or like, what's your challenge? Well, the organization's biggest challenge. Yeah,
I think it's relevance. I mean, I think the organization's obviously hugely relevant right now. Mm. But it's really looking to retain that relevance as our societies change around us. Yeah. So what we know is that, you know, hunting and fishing used to be part of who we are as New Zealanders, and I think it's still part of who we are as New Zealanders. It's also very much embedded in our cultural heritage as well. So I think it's there. But what we've been seeing is urbanisation of our population. So they've moved away from from their rural landscapes and connections. And so it's harder for people to, you know, have that opportunity to learn about hunting and fishing and then to get out there and actually enjoy it. So I think one of the biggest challenges for the organisation is to support people to understand what Fish and Game is about, to value hunting and fishing. It's more than just taking animals from the environment, right? For me, I hunt and fish because I'm an animal lover, but I also eat meat. And so it's a choice that I make to ensure that the meat that I eat is as ethically sourced as I can possibly make it. So there's that. There's also the mental health and well-being benefits of being out in natural environment and harvesting your food from it, as well as those ethical benefits.
Yeah.
So it's about teaching people about that. And it's also about providing people the opportunities so that they can learn where to go and how to do these activities safely. So I think that's the big challenge for the organisation now and into the future, and where I would hope that we're focusing. So it's building our social licence. It's helping people understand what it is, why people hunt and fish, what the values are, and then how to do it.
Why do you think kind of that the hunting and fishing is being questioned? It's being questioned internationally, like the role of hunting and fishing. I mean, there was a podcast I listened to the other day where someone's a ocean biologist, and they was like, fishing is so harmful, like fishing for recreation is so harmful. And they basically said, stop fishing for recreation. Really? Like, are you saying that people who fish for recreation are having more of an impact than bottom trawling or something? Like, and it's a big political movement also. Like, obviously you must have thoughts about that. Like, why do you think these things are being questioned, or it's being seen as, you know, cruel or just not relevant in society anymore?
I think it's just messaging. I think people have moved away from, you know, where they grew up with their grandparents hunting and fishing, and you know, it was part of who they were as a family. So they've been disconnected from the land and disconnected from where their food comes from, and then buying into narratives, you know, that indicate that hunting and fishing is not good for the environment or is cruel in relation to animals. And so that's why I think we need to really show people what this is about. You know, I think it's the most sustainable way of existing as a human being and connecting across your family. You know, the animals that we're harvesting, you know, if thinking about deer, which is not Fish and Game, right, that's the Game Animal Council and hunters out there. But if we just take that as an example, you know, you're not only providing food for your family in relation to a meat source, which is amazing. You know, it's a really free range, organic, carbon neutral, essentially source of protein. You've got the health benefits of being out there in the environment. All the hunters and fish and people that fish that I know are huge conservationists. They understand the environment because they're in it all the time and they can live in it, and they give back. And also, you know, with some of the species that we're harvesting, you know, there's biodiversity management as well. So you're protecting biodiversity at the same time.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think people are having those conversations about, you know, the real value of being a hunter-gatherer type person and embedding that and bringing those values into your family.
Is that what the Rewild campaign is trying to do? Well, what is the Rewild campaign? Maybe just like define that and let's talk about it.
We launched our Rewild campaign last year. And really that's about showcasing the benefits of hunting and fishing. So a little bit, it's about showcasing what fishing game does. So now allowing people to look at the bottom of the iceberg or underneath the hood, but also it's about showcasing the benefits of hunting and fishing. I think it's really about not rebranding it, but getting people to see it in a different light. So it's not just about one demographic out there in a certain environment, right? Mm-hmm. It's about making it attainable for everybody. One of my passions is bringing females into hunting and fishing, and we know that there's a huge opportunity here. When we bring women into hunting and fishing, they love it. It's a sense of empowerment, self-sufficiency, and being able to provide for your family. And there's been something like an 18% increase in females getting into fishing in particular over the last decade. So it's significant and growing. So that's one of my passions that drive me. But the other one is you know, all ethnicities, genders and ages being able to access and get into hunting and fishing so that it's attainable. It's not something that just a few can do.
So give me an example of what, like how the Rewild campaign kind of works, like how it hooks those people that are not kind of familiar with it in like social media.
That's right. Yes. So we're using massive social media platforms. We've, you know, got the logo out there. We are doing sort of emails as well. So it's sort of like a softer campaign at the moment, and it's just getting reach. So with the social media platforms, for example, you know, they've been shared across those platforms. The language has been picked up and used by different influencers as well. So it's a way of bringing us all into utilizing similar language, which talks about what we do in a way that people can easily understand it. I think historically, hunters and fishers have just spoken to people that hunt and fish. You know, that's been the audience. Rewild is about talking to people that don't hunt and fish necessarily.
Yeah.
And it's about ensuring that people that don't hunt and fish understand why people hunt and fish and what the value is it. And so they will value it even if they don't do it themselves.
Yeah.
And also to encourage people to get into hunting and fishing. And also those that have hunted and fished before, but have for various reasons, you know, life gets a bit tough and busy, especially when you're raising kids and you're trying to earn your bread at the same time, you know, to encourage them to get back into it because it's so good for mental health and well-being and for connection across those families, you know, the family units. It's brilliant for getting kids off devices. So it's really about getting those key messages out there.
I don't want to say how do you draw the right people, but a couple of times I've been out with new hunters and fishermen. Okay, and then it's great. But once or twice I've had the experience where people read books and they're like, oh, I don't need to zero a rifle. I just kind of just like, you know, bore sighted and stuff. Like, how do you create a tradition where that also has like that responsibility and the full understanding of like where your respect for the quarry comes in? Like, how do you create that? Is this just time or like, yeah.
That's right. I think it's about the first thing you do is I talk about it as influencing the influencers, though in this respect, you don't need to, you know, our influencers are very ethical and they understand etiquette.
Yeah.
You know, so they already message that. So it's about leveraging those messaging, leveraging the influencers that people look up to through the social media platforms, YouTube platforms, TV, for example. So, I mean, those guys are really amazing. Guys and girls are really incredible. So it's about utilizing that. It's also about, you know, all the imagery that you put up and the messages that you put up. So it's very clear about what it is we stand for, what our values are, and the ethics and the etiquette around hunting and fishing to make sure that, you know, we've got animal welfare top of mind and safety top of mind for the people that are out there doing it. You know, gun safety is a huge thing, and so we're really pushing that and partnering with the, you know, the various influencers and the Firearms Safety Authority, for example, to get those key messages out there. I talk a lot about building extension material, and what I mean by that is resources that support child and adult education and learning. And so they might be podcasts, YouTube clips, fact sheets, but they're also workshops and field days. And so very much emulating, I think, what the primary industry does so well in connecting with their farmers, utilising that type of framework to connect with their hunters and anglers, and provide them the best opportunity to really enjoy hunting and angling in a safe, sustainable and ethical way.
I interviewed, I don't know if you know the guys from the Weekend Mish, or if you're aware of them. It's like super young guys doing massive missions. And I've seen recently how their kind of communication about hunting and fishing has changed. Like, they'll talk about utilizing the whole animal, and it's just subtle things coming through that you go like, oh, okay, this is a topic there. I mean, maybe that's your fault. Maybe you influenced them, but you know, it is interesting. And I think those messages do hit home if they're out there. And I've also seen the other thing is I've seen a massive amount of female influencers on Instagram now hunting and fishing and like doing massive missions that I'm thinking like, I probably won't make it across that mountain, or I won't be able to handle the cold. How important is that female influencer out there?
Obviously, I'm biased. I think it's hugely important. Yeah. Females talk about things in a different way, and they bring a different flavor to the things that they're doing, right? So I completely agree with what you said around the influencers as well, too. So I think the thing that I didn't say before is you'll see a lot more, you know, people or influencers when they're hunting and fishing, they're utilizing as much of that animals as is possible. And the experience is not just the harvesting of that animal, being out in the environment, it's the entire experience. And so now they're talking about the entire experience, and that's right through to plate. You know, so it's how you process that animal, how you cook that animal, and then the enjoyment of that as a group of friends or a family. And that's really important. I think the female influence in that is really important because that's what females really enjoy. So they'll talk about the whole experience, and they make everything really attainable. So, you know, they'll talk about, you know, how they push through their boundaries and what you need to manage. I think for females, a lot of it is, for me personally, I'll just talk about that really, rather than talking about females in general. I'll get myself in trouble. For me, I've got to push through some, you know, physical limitations, a little bit smaller and a little bit lighter, which means I'm not quite as strong as, you know, so those my male counterparts that are out there hunting and fishing all the time. So I need to manage my temperature quite closely. So I'll make sure that my gear is appropriate and that, you know, I'm careful about not getting cold. And as soon as I get a bit chilly, you know, I wrap up and I talk about these things, and I make sure that I've got, you know, I've got access to food, and that I'm sort of keeping my energy levels up. So, and females will talk about that. Whereas, you know, I think in the past, we weren't talking about those sort of things. You know, you had this image of what it would mean to be an outdoors person, you know, big and rugged and tough. I think females coming into it, which are still super tough, they're just bringing a different element to it, and you know, and talk about those things that we really didn't talk about. And I think that's really important that we have that we just make this accessible, and we really humanize it.
I think even for new people coming in, like coming from Africa where it's just mostly warm all the time, cold is a big thing for me. So I always listen to those talks where someone talks about how do you manage cold, because if I stop moving, I need to wrap up immediately. Otherwise, I feel my hands ruined. Like, I don't enjoy it anymore. You're basically just like eating to stay warm and moving to stay warm, and all the enjoyment goes out of it. Another thing I always wonder about, and I work in farming mostly, but how do you manage kind of the bad actors in something? Like, how do you manage someone who does not act appropriately or breaks a law or something? Like, I'm a bit of an extremist. I sometimes feel like, no, let's just, you know, tar and feather them. But obviously that's definitely not. Like, how do you feel in today's modern society where there's all these massive feelings against hunting and fishing? How do we manage someone as an industry that's maybe not acting appropriately? Like, how do we communicate about that?
I think the first thing is to be really clear about what the challenges are to hunting and fishing now and into the future, so that anyone that is out there hunting, fishing feels that responsibility to actually make sure that they are good custodians and everyone is an ambassador for hunting and fishing. Because if we want to do it now and into the future, we need to really maintain our social license, which means the highest level of etiquette and ethics around hunting and fishing and safety. So I think first it's really education, right? So it's making sure that everyone clearly understands what the challenges are, and also what does sustainable ethical hunting and fishing look like? What are our values and how do we hold to those values? And so I think first up is education, and then it's access to material so people can readily learn. And I think there's a huge role in our influencers in showing people what it means to be a hunter and an angler, and how to do this in a way that really retains our social license, and what our values are. I think now more than ever before, there's also a huge element of peer pressure. More hunters and anglers understand that their ability to hunt and fish depends on them being influencers in their own right. And now you'll see them call out other people that are hunting and fishing, or educate them if they're seeing behavior or imagery that isn't consistent with who we are as a group of passionate individuals.
Yeah, I saw that. Well, the Weekend Mish, I don't know why I'm using them as an example now, but they were hunting and a chamois that was shot and just left. And they were just saying, like, this is a waste. Or who did that? Who shot the animal and just left it there? That I think that's going to become more important in future with the social license. Looking at the bottom of the iceberg work that fishing game does that a lot of people aren't aware of in terms of habitat, what's the biggest challenges that's facing the habitat now? Because I mean, braided rivers are being like squeezed, river quality, wetlands, or you know, just historical draining of wetlands. Like, what are the key things that you would want fishing game maybe over the next 10 years to focus on in terms of habitat and the challenges? Yeah, like, what are the challenges?
We've got multiple challenges, and I think we've been talking about them, you know, for a very long time, the last 30 years, and there's nothing new there. So we've got challenges in relation to freshwater health. That's from multiple sources. So I think historically fishing game's talked about agricultural land uses. And definitely we've got some challenges in some areas around intensification of some agricultural land uses. And, you know, Canterbury is, you know, a hotspot that we sort of talk about, and where they've got active management and there's a whole lot more regulation being put in place down there now to address some of those issues. So freshwater health is definitely a challenge, but it's not, you know, it's not just agriculture, and it's not all of agriculture. I just want to be really clear about that. We've got beautiful parts of the country where we've got a lot of agriculture and there's no problems or limited problems. So they're not everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not all agriculture. We've got, you know, our cities and that are causing, you know, serious problems. So you've got sewage discharge straight into rivers and you know, Auckland comes to mind in relation to the harbours. You've got breakdown infrastructure there, and you've got a growing population, and all of that puts pressure on the resource. So I think all of us are part of protecting the environment, understanding what our own footprint is and trying to minimise that footprint. You know, we're all part of the solution, I think, and we all need to work collectively together to address it. I think on top of that, you've got climate change type of events. So Cyclone Gabrielle comes to mind in the Hawke's Bay, you know, that devastated those communities, and in Gisborne as well, Tairāwhiti. And so those are the other areas that are sort of causing impacts, those sort of extreme weather events. They in particular impact on our salmonid fisheries. You know, they're not great with floods. They, you know, they didn't evolve here. You know, they're naturalized over the last 150 years, but a little bit more sensitive than some of our native species to these sort of big disturbance events. So Hawke's Bay, for example, you know, we've got amazing rivers that are still fishing incredibly well over there. And we've had a couple that have been really impacted by that cyclone. So that's probably a newer element that's coming in now. We need to more understand what those physical disturbances are going to mean for our populations over a longer period of time as they are predicted to get worse.
Do you think there's conflict with the new Minister of Agriculture and being the Minister of Hunting and Fishing? Because, you know, there's some of these tensions. It seems like you're the right person to handle it because you've got experience in kind of both fields. Like, how does that conversation look? Or, you know, how do you strike a balance between the two? You know, the one is something you can't destroy, obviously, habitat, but you've got the economy. Like, how do you think about that?
I think that they can work hand in glove. I've had a background in working with the primary industries, and I'm really passionate about farming as well. And I always will be. You know, I live in a farming community. I spend a lot of my time out on farms on the weekend hunting.
Yeah.
I've got my friends are farmers.
Yeah.
I have a livestock block myself, and understand how difficult it is to manage the land and take care of your animals. So I'm really passionate about the primary industries as well as I am about hunting and fishing. I think they work together. You know, I think the solution is open conversations. I think it's about kindness, obviously, you know, so you can break down those tensions, and you need to build a trust model so you can all sing from the same song sheet, and work collectively to find solutions that are good for the environment and good for farming. And naturally they should be, because the environment is the building blocks of the farm. So to have a sustainable farming business, you need to have those building blocks need to be healthy, and that's the environment. And so many of the farmers that I work with in the past, that's just what they do. So there's no tension there.
Yeah,
I think we've created tension in the media a lot. I think there are some areas where there's a little bit more tension, but I think if we build good relationships and we work together, then we'll get there. And I'm sure, you know, the Minister of Hunting and Fishing, who's the Minister of, you know, the primary industries and trade, you know, that's great having that combined portfolio, because that's the approach that should be taken, bringing people together and looking for common solutions.
Yeah. Do you, like, if you were asking the questions for, let's say you were asking the question not to you, but like someone else at Fish and Game sitting in upper management, what questions would you ask? Like, what do you think the journalists aren't asking, or you know, what aren't people asking because they're maybe not in it and they're not aware of it? Is there anything that you think is important that kind of flies under the radar?
I think people should be talking about what the solutions are. You know, so much we've talked about what the problems are, and we all understand what those problems are, but I'm not sure we're having that really mature conversation around what the solutions are. So I think it would be, you know, so we've got this challenge, what is the solution? And we need to come together and have those conversations. And I think that's what we're really needing. I also think we're needing leadership. And so the question should be, who are our leaders and what are they saying and where are they taking us and over what time frame?
Yeah.
I think the time frame question is really important. What I would hate to see is policy solutions or, you know, solutions put in place that are a 3-year term or a 6-year term or a very short horizon, and they're ultimately going to have perverse outcomes or worse outcomes, you know, for current generations. So we need to be saying, who are our leaders? What are our issues? And what do those solutions look like? And how long will it take us to get there? And where are they taking us?
For Fish and Game, when a new, you know, let's say the shift between Labour and National, does that massively impact you? Because I know for farming, there might be quite big differences, but are you just kind of, you know, tracking along and doing your thing, or with every government change, are you like, okay, now we're going to have to completely rethink it? Like, does that have such a big influence on you?
It shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Fish and Game's got a job to do. It needs to be focused on just doing its job. It's a statutory organisation with some key deliverables, and they don't change depending on who the government is. I think I said should do, because how we talk about what we do and how we talk about those solutions may change with who the government is. Slightly different languages, slightly different values. But ultimately, you know, Fish and Game's apolitical statutory organisation, and it has a job to do, and it should just get on and get that job done.
Yeah.
It needs to be working on relationships across parties. So the best solutions are those ones that you know, that all parties support, and that's where the organisation is focused on. So maintaining strong relationships irrespective of who's in power at the time, and looking for cross-party support for long-term solutions.
Okay. If you had 3 weeks off, your own time, someone else funded it, where would you go and what would you do?
Such a great question. I'm thinking Stewart Island at the moment. The number of managers across the organisation that get down there on a fairly regular basis, and they tell amazing stories of just hanging out and doing a bit of hunting and fishing. And so I think I'd love to get down to Stewart Island and just spend a bit of time down there with mates, rewilding myself.
Yeah.
Obviously, the other thing that I love to do is I love to hang out with my family. So, you know, get my family that's in New Plymouth to go up to Northland and hang out with the cousins and the uncles and aunties up there. So that's the other thing that I love to do. They're you know, obviously a super cool bunch, and we spend a lot of time outdoors.
That's awesome. And then internationally, if you would had time and someone else was funding it.
Well, we live. I'm just like, why travel overseas when we have everything that we want in New Zealand?
Yeah.
So I've done a little bit of travel in the past with work and training horses and things like that, and it is amazing to see different parts of the world. But I'm just really passionate about New Zealand. I just want to spend more time here looking around. I suppose, I mean, maybe there's some, you know, I'd love to go visit pigeon hunting in Argentina or something like that.
Those big
horse treks internationally, you know, is probably on my bucket list. I'll do. But at this stage, I'm just really focused on spending time at home, exploring New Zealand's beautiful wilderness and hanging out with really cool people.
Southland is definitely a place to be. I've grown really fond of Southland. Everyone, when we moved here from Auckland, said it's you know, all the city slickers said it's a dumb move, and all the outdoors people said that's a great move. But I'd love to spend more time in South Otago. I think there's a ton of stuff to do there. So, what's your next mission? Like, when are you going to hit a river or anything? Like, what are you going to do this weekend or maybe next weekend that's outdoorsy?
Yeah, this weekend I think I'm going to go for go see if I can find a fallow. Yep. So we'll go do some deer hunting, and just re-stretch the legs after the epic adventure I've just been on, and loosen up some muscles, which have got a bit tight. And then I think after that, I want to get the shotgun out and do some clay bird practice so that I'm on game for the beginning of the game birds. Super looking forward to that. I think we've got a great opening weekend planned. And then I really want to get Bracken out hunting pheasants and enjoy that up here. And we've got some great opportunities and, you know, along the Rangitiki River, for example, to hunt pheasants. And Rotorua comes to mind as well. So I might do a trip over there.
That sounds awesome. Two other questions. What rifle are you shooting at the moment when you're shooting fallow or red deer?
Well, I've got a 7mm 08, and I've just sent that to some experts to be kitted out. I'm a big fan of do what you're good at, and obviously I'm not good at that, so I just send it to the people that is their job and that's their bread and butter, and so they'll sort that out for me and then send it back to me, and it'll be great. So at the moment I'm shooting with a Mates 308.
And shotgun, have you got a shotgun that you're using?
I have got a shotgun. It doesn't fit me very well, so we're just re-looking at that. It's a Beretta kickoff over and under 12 gauge. So I quite like it, like a little bit of a heavier gun for me, because I had a Silver Pigeon when I first started, and 20 gauge probably wasn't the best gun to, a beautiful, beautiful gun, but probably not the best to learn on, because I developed a bit of a flinch because it was kicking me around in the face a bit and I've broken my face. So we're just working there, and I need something that's just a little bit shorter than what I've currently got.
Silver Pigeon is a beautiful, and then the 7mm 08 is a very Kiwi caliber. I don't know if you know that, but like, no one in South Africa shot 7mm 08, but then coming here, everybody loves a 7mm 08. So yeah, it's got a lot of a tradition in New Zealand.
It's just such a handy, versatile rifle. Yeah, it's just a ticker out of the box.
Yeah.
Pop on a good scope, pop on a good bipod, shorten it up a bit, and away you go.
Yeah, it's going to knock things over. Karina, awesome. Thanks. Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Hopefully we can talk again in future about other things and awesome work that Fish and Game is doing. Like, really, really a big fan. And great to know that there's this massive organization that kind of just, I pay a little fee and all these things happen to make my weekends better. So yeah, thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. Have a great day.
Cool. Cheers.